After Jesus was born, some wise astrologers from modern-day Iran came to Jerusalem.
They arrive in the city and start asking people in the street, "Where is this new king who's been born? We've been studying the stars for years, and they pointed us here, and we wish to worship him."
King Herod and the other rulers who rule in Jerusalem, when they heard about this, they were distressed.
King Herod called all the Jewish priests and teachers of the law into one place and asked them, "Where is the promised king supposed to be born?"
They answered, "In a small town called Bethlehem, as it's written in the scriptures, 'To you, O Bethlehem, will come a ruler. He will shepherd your people Israel.'"
So Herod called the stargazers into his court and asked them for the exact time the star appeared in the sky.
Herod sent them to Bethlehem. "Go, search carefully for the child, and then report to me, so that I too can worship him."
So the stargazers went outside and looked up into the night sky and read the stars and found that they pointed south to Bethlehem.
When the astrologers learned from the stars where Jesus was, they were overjoyed.
They arrive in Bethlehem, and they find the child and his mother Mary, and they bow down and worship him.
They present to him, to the baby, precious gifts of gold, incense, myrrh.
And after being warned in a dream not to return to King Herod, they return to Iran by a different route.
G'day. Welcome, visitors. A warm welcome to you. Welcome, Willoughby Church community. It's good to be here in worship on this Christmas day. William Kurelek, who Josh pointed our attention to a moment ago, is a Canadian folk artist. And in his book, Northern Nativity, he's trying to, I suppose, retell in 2012 terms what it looked like for Jesus to become human. I really love the book. Aaron, who's Canadian, introduced Kurelek to me. And this one's my favourite scene, the service station scene. Okay, gas station scene. And I like that. That rings true to me, that there wasn't a hotel, there wasn't a motel available. And so the owner of the gas station lets them stay in their shop. It's a great appropriation, I think. The equivalent for me, as I said a couple of nights ago at the Sufyan night, the equivalent for me is I used to live in Australia before we came here in the poorest area, the poorest suburb of Sydney. It was an area called Mount Druitt. We had a man on charges of murder living next door. It's kind of high crime, high poverty, government housing area. And Emmerton Pub was just around the corner. And I imagine Jesus being born, I've imagined this for a few years now, Jesus being born about 1 a.m., around the time that Emmerton Pub closes, and sluggish patrons wandering by the house where Jesus is born make a racket that rivals the noise of the crying baby. I really appreciate Kurelek. He brings home the reality of it for me. And I love this installation that our resident artists have done, a whole lot of Kurelek paintings. And Sue Contant and Janice Tolkamp are our artists, and they wrote a paragraph about this work. And they wrote this, and I'm going to quote the artist now. "The plain burlap beams represent Christ coming to us in the ordinary." That's great. And to me, it represents Christ being born into a peasant family in the Roman Empire. And the artist wrote as well that the shopping cart represents, I quote, "our consumerism and the homelessness within our society." That's great. And I suppose it represents to Christ's family's homelessness at that time. Now, I love this one. These burlap kind of radiating from the shopping cart to the map of the world. And the artist wrote, "His power and glory reaches all the earth." Isn't that fantastic? It's one of the best sacred installations I've ever seen, I think, if not the best. I love it. I posted it on Facebook. Well, I would like to illustrate all of this from music now. Apologies to those who came to the Sufyan evening. There's going to be a little bit of overlap, but I think you'll cope. But I've got a few reasons for repeating it. And just to explain, I'm a jazz and blues musician, and I want to tell you a little bit about jazz and blues music and relate it to what we're talking about in the incarnation. So in Western classical music, it's, I suppose, a primary interval in Western classical music is what's called a major third. So here's middle C, and here's the second degree of the scale, 1-2, and here's 3. That's C and E just there. And of course, to our ears, that sounds harmonious. It's a harmony. 1 and 3, a major third is a harmony. And Western classical music, particularly in the classical period, the time of Mozart in the 1700s, or the Romantic period in the 1800s, is characterized by that kind of harmony, major thirds, major fifths, and it's fairly easy on the Western ear. But jazz and blues is characterized, as you probably know, by a different set of intervals, often by dissonance. And let me just illustrate that. Another word for dissonance could be trouble. So here is the major third again. And I'll just rise it one semitone up to a fourth. There's a bit more trouble there, but it's not bad. But raise that another semitone, C to G flat, and you've got what jazz musicians and blues musicians call a tritone, and that's trouble. But that's what jazz and blues is constructed on, that sound right there. And this sound, which is a minor seventh. It's pretty wild, eh? And there's a very good reason for it. It's a historical reason, because jazz and blues is born in the oppression of black slavery in the US. That's where it's born. It's born on the work songs of the black African-American slaves, and it's born also in the churches where they worshipped and sung. And it sings a song of slavery. It sings a song of the grief of the world. And to illustrate this musically further, here would be perhaps an Amazing Grace played in a classical way. A whole lot of major thirds. A pianist isn't going to be thrown out of his church for playing Amazing Grace like that. But if one was to play it in a jazz style, dissonance would be introduced. So that's okay. Bit of trouble there. You could definitely be thrown out for that. Thank goodness, we're home. But we're not safe for long. Hear that? Well, there's plenty of churches you could be thrown out for that. And I love jazz and blues music, and I think jazz and blues music is always going to be listened to because the world, this side of Christ's return, is always grieving. And just this week I've heard of cluster bombs being dropped by the Syrian government on Syrian towns, and cluster bombs, as you know, is an indiscriminate way of bombing that kills civilians and anyone who are in their way. And I've also heard from the New York Times this week that more than any time in previous decades, it's more difficult for someone in the US who's born into relative poverty to get to college and find a job. It's harder for those born into relative poverty in the US now to make it than it was 10 years ago or 20 years ago. And the world is grieving in the West and in the majority world, and blues and jazz sings a song of that grief. And I think that blues and jazz, to me, is the sound of the nativity and Jesus' birth. And I want to illustrate that, why blues and jazz is a suitable art form to sing something of the grief. And you can get a sense of the grief and the hardship here from the installation. Let me tell you my favorite Christmas story. My favorite Christmas story starts in Isaiah chapter 9, and it's repeated by Matthew in Matthew chapter 4. It's a prophecy by the prophet Isaiah 500 years before Jesus, and this is what it says. To Zebulun and Naphtali, that's two Israelite tribes, the land, Galilee of the Gentiles, a land living in darkness, a light has dawned. Now let me explain that from the map. Zebulun and Naphtali is up where it says Galilee. See that top body of water there? That's where the tribes in Old Testament times, were 500 years before Jesus, were. And it says, in Zebulun and Naphtali, Galilee of the Gentiles, you can see that there, top of the map, Galilee, a people dwelling in darkness has dawned a great light. Now, people in Isaiah's time would know exactly what that means. Everyone knows that Galilee is a backwater suburb. You see, to the north of Galilee are the enemies, are the empires. And if Israel is going to be attacked, it'll be from the north. Do you get that? Can you see above Galilee? That's where the enemies are. And so if armies come to Israel, and they do, they'll come through Galilee. So anyone with means, anyone with ability to move house, anyone with some money will go south and live in the capital cities of Samaria and Jerusalem. You won't live in Galilee if you got half a chance. Galilee is a backwater suburb, a bit like Emmerdon Pub. You won't live there unless you can help it. And this is a remarkable thing about Isaiah chapter 9, this quote. It says, to a land living in darkness, to Galilee, a light has dawned. That 500 years before Christ had come, 500 years before, God, when he came, was always going to come to Galilee. Christ, when he came, was always going to come to a backwater suburb where no one would want to live. And this is why that's remarkable. I would imagine if Christ came to Vancouver today, if Christ was incarnate in 2012-13 in Vancouver, he'd come to Kitsilano Beach, right? Wouldn't God come to the cafe stretch on Kitsilano Beach or the equivalent? But he was always, God, when he came to save, was always going to come to Galilee of the Gentiles. He was always going to come to the poorest suburb, to Emmerdon Pub, maybe to Hastings Street, the Vancouver equivalent. And isn't that the kind of God this world needs? Isn't that the kind of God that American poverty needs and that Assyria needs? That's the kind of God that the world needs. So I want to play another song now. I want to play a song called The Nativity Blues. And it's going to sing something of the grief of Christ's coming and the grief of Christ's life. That's the God we need. But it's also going to, of course, blues and jazz always has a tone of joy and richness and depth and celebration about it. So The Nativity Blues expresses something of the restoration that Christ brings as well. So here's The Nativity Blues. Well, I come back now to the reading that Brad and I kind of presented a minute ago. And we'll finish with this. In the reading were the astrologers, the wise astrologers who went and saw Jesus. Now, I have a question for you before I start, and we're going to vote on this just before we get into the story. Do you think that in the Bible it says that there were three wise men, or do you think that that number three for the wise men is just made up? If you think that there are, if it says there are three wise men in the Bible, you have to vote here. Raise your hand if you think the Bible says there are three wise men. Raise your Bible if you think that it doesn't say there are three wise men. Raise your hand. A few brave ones. Raise your hand if you have tennis elbow or other kind of inflammation so you can't vote. Well, you're right, it doesn't say there are three wise men. Very good. Why then do people assume there were three? Three gifts, right, three gifts, that's right, yeah. And the wise astrologers, they were probably astrologers and they made their living by reading the stars and then by reacting to that, casting spells and omens probably in order to change the future. So that would have been their role. And that word magi that's attached to them, as you probably know, is behind the English word magic. So they were magicians of sorts. But what they were doing wasn't just a sleight of hand. There was a reality to what they were doing. The spiritual world is real. And they did have a certain power about them. Something else it seems to me is that they were probably not just magi, but they probably made a bit of a living as they wandered about as merchants, as traveling traders. And it seems to me probably that when they, it says that in Matthew chapter 2, they opened their treasures, and I suppose that was they opened the goods that they were traveling with to trade. I think probably they weren't kind of, they didn't leave home with gifts to bear, like the carol says, but they probably gave really, really generously at a cost from the goods that they were going to trade, and it wouldn't have left them with much more, I wouldn't think. But I think I really love this story because to me it grounds Jesus' birth in material reality. And let me point out two different ways that the wise men speaks deeply into this story. Number one, I find it remarkable that they saw Jesus' birth written on the stars. I'll just say what that looked like. I don't think it looked like it looks in the storybooks where these astrologers were kind of chasing a star around. You know, like in the US, in the tornado season, people chase tornadoes. I think it was rather that they were astrologers who read the stars. They saw in the stars, in the constellations, and the movement between the stars and the planets, what was going to happen. And I think it's remarkable. I think that's amazing. It's worth saying, too, that in the Bible, there's warnings about that. There's warnings about that practice, that it's a dangerous practice, that it's an unhealthy practice. So in light of all that, I find it amazing that by God's grace, the very stars, the constellations, align with Jesus' birth and are available to astute astrologers to observe. And it's a pagan practice. It's not what good Jews do, yet Christ is Lord over all of creation and all of creation responds. Christ's restorative work is for the whole of creation and his coming sparks the interest even of the stars. Christ is Lord and restorer of all of creation. I think it's incredible that the stars are involved here. And we sung earlier the second last verse of Joy to the World, and I love these words about Christ as restorer of the whole world. No more let sins and sorrows grow, nor thorns infest the ground. He comes to make his blessings flow everywhere, as far as the curse is found, as far as the curse is found. Economics, politics, poverty, as far as the curse is found. That's the first thing I love about this story. Here's the second thing. The second thing I love about this story is the paradoxical image, the very striking image of three, whatever, grown men, I'm sure it wasn't three, three men worshipping a little baby. It's a very striking image. It never happens, right? Well, very rarely. Here's what I love about this image, that here in this baby, God came, God the Son, Jesus Christ, as a human being. And here the baby is with skin, with freckles, with sunburn, and yet he's worshipped as God. And what's remarkable about this, in God becoming human flesh, is that in becoming human, in entering this creation, understand this, God is placing a huge, giant, planet-sized tick over his creation. When he becomes human, he's as much as saying, I love this world, I love it enough to enter it. I will love this world to life. A huge planet-sized tick over all of creation. And this is the message of Christmas. More than anything else, this is the message of Christmas. This world matters to God, every square inch of it. And I say again, this world needs a God like that. A God who enters his creation as a human being. A God who comes to Galilee, who doesn't come to Kitsilano, but comes to the outskirts, to the backwater suburbs, a God who's born in Galilee. And so, to finish, here is the burlap standing for the humility of God. And as the artist said, I quote, his power and glory reaches all the earth. When Handel wrote the Messiah, of course, the Messiah is a very famous piece. It's a famous Christmas piece, and rightly so. Can you picture him? He is there in the room where he's writing, and he has the score in front of him on the table, writing this fantastic piece of music. And Handel's Messiah, as many of you will know, is written on Isaiah 40. It's about God coming. It's incredible. It says, for example, in the Messiah, in Isaiah 40, lay low the hills, raise up the valleys, make a highway so that God can come to this world quickly and fix it up. Raise those hills, raise up the valleys so that God can come. Please hurry. And the story is that as Handel is writing this Messiah, his servant calls to him, Handel, and Handel didn't answer. Handel, he calls three or four times. Handel, Handel. And he didn't answer. And so the servant walks into the room where he's writing his score. And Handel has his head on the desk weeping. And he's writing that part in the Messiah, straight from Isaiah 40, that speaks and says, here is your God. He's come. Amen.